Oh, hello, I didn't see you there.
He's shaking the dust off his vocal muscles. It's been a while for us.
I didn't see you there. I'm just relaxing with a good book. Hello, and welcome to the Spoiler Show.
Spoiler Show Book Club.
Book Club edition.
Featuring smoking jackets. Yeah.
Can you smell the rich mahogany wood of the smoking room? My study. Here, we're joined today by His Majesty's Dragon, a fine novel by Naomi Novik.
Yeah, there is a bit of an Edmonton connection to Naomi Novik. She worked at Hometown Heroes BioWare a couple of years ago. She worked on
Thrilling copywriter.
Neverwinter Nights. She did stuff for them.
So back when BioWare was making that hearty classic of role-playing genre, Neverwinter Nights.
A young Naomi Novik
was... A young Naomi Novik, writing the books, perhaps, in the Neverwinter Nights universe that you could read optionally.
Maybe.
Or perhaps writing something more important. We'll never know until we have her as a guest.
Yeah, stay tuned, folks.
Stay tuned. She may join us for our rousing Ryan Gosling episode at the end of this season.
It is going to be amazing. You guys have no idea all the crazy crap that's going to happen. Anyway, inaugural Spoiler Show Book Club.
Yeah, we hope some of you, at least, have taken us up on our offer of reading His Majesty's Dragon by Naomi Novik, and you're ready to have a nice little fireside chat with your friends Matt and Marcus.
If not, you know, read it. It'll take you like 2 days. It's great.
Yeah, the thing that I really liked about this movie, this book, first of all, it's so good it feels like a movie.
Well, it's going to be a movie.
Yeah, it's been optioned by Peter Jackson.
You were wondering why I went through 17 printings. Well, there you go.
Yeah, it's a really solid book. I mean, the spine on mine isn't even cracked.
Mine's pretty beat up.
I only read it for about 12 hours before I finished it. Like, it's an interesting combination of styles where it's the sort of movie or book. It's the sort of book
that you can... It's a cinematic read.
Well, it's the sort of book that you can, like, plow through really quickly, but it also doesn't feel like trash. Like, there are books out there that you can read really quickly because they're poorly written and they just feel trashy.
Yeah.
This book actually manages to maintain a pretty solid period Victorian tone.
Yeah. Regency.
Yeah, Regency. Yeah. True, yeah. Pre-Victorian.
Yeah. It's just really good attention to detail. Like, it is, like, you would call it pulp literature, but it's in the same vein as a Horatio Hornblower or Flashman, just kind of these really fun period pieces where, you know, there is a strict hierarchical order going on.
Yeah.
Kind of, the heroes are always bucking against this system in some way, so it's palatable to the modern audience.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing here, obviously, is...
How about a little plot lay down.
So yeah, that's what I was about to do.
Yeah.
So the big thing here, essentially, is we're looking at Napoleonic Europe, and there are dragons. Mm-hmm. So it's a world where dragons have just, you know, evolved along with humankind, and humans have managed to domesticate dragons, of all things.
I want a prequel about that. I want to know about the first guy.
You want the Guns, Germs, and Steel version of why it's possible for humans to domesticate a goddamn dragon?
Yeah, they must have been a lot. Like, I think if you read the back, there is a pretty good sort of taxonomy of dragons. You learn about the different species and things.
Yeah.
And if I feel like they've kind of bred them to be these big beasts. They might have been smaller, like the size of an elephant or something smaller like that, that, you know, our reality has managed to domesticate.
Yeah, in the world of the books, the wild dragons are always much smaller than the domesticated dragons. I think that's true of actually a lot of animals that have been domesticated. It's still kind of bizarre that, you know, we're a species that hasn't managed to domesticate elephants or cheetahs.
Well, domesticate Like Hannibal rode elephants. It depends on your definition of domesticate, right?
Well, so my definition of domesticate is the definition of domesticate, which is to say
that we've,
we develop animal husbandry techniques that allow us to breed these animals in captivity. The animals are tame enough that they don't kill us all the time.
How does that not include an elephant? I mean,
they're not, you know. Elephant breeding programs are really poor. Like it's much more. Like the elephants that they use in Asia, for instance, right now, as pack animals in Thailand and stuff like that, those elephants are almost always just wild elephants
that they
tame. Huh. Yeah, they just trap and tame them. It's much cheaper to just tame an elephant than it is to try and breed elephants in captivity and get them to give up their young and all that sort of thing.
I guess there's what? There's only like two kinds of elephants, right?
Yeah, there's the African and the Asian elephant, as far as I know.
And if we domesticated them, there'd be a bunch more.
There would be a lot more. Yeah. We would be using them.
Anyway.
Can you imagine the amount of meat that you would get off of an Asian elephant or an African elephant?
I totally want to eat one.
Yeah, well, it happens every so often in Africa. I mean, all the elephants that get like on the reserves and stuff. Yeah. Well, even on the game reserves in Africa, every so often an elephant will be, you know, like really sick or, you know, be injured to the point where the wardens need to kill it. All of those elephants, all of the meat from those elephants gets donated back to all the communities around them in Africa.
That's good.
So there are all sorts of African tribes people who know and love the taste of elephant.
What would you imagine it tastes like?
It's a really good question. I think evolutionarily speaking, they're reasonably related to, like, horses and whales are, like, the, I think, are the close-ish relatives. And so, I mean, who knows what whale tastes like, but horse apparently tastes close enough to beef that people can't even tell.
Yeah, if you've been to IKEA in Europe, you may have eaten some horse.
Yeah, so I'm going to wager it probably tastes pretty beefy.
Yeah, maybe a little bit of peanut.
Ooh, boom.
Yeah, pretty good. Anyway, going back to the book, so the story of the book is that...
Yeah, so, you know, taking for granted the fact that it could possibly be, like, even remotely plausible that humans would be able to domesticate animals that are
50 feet long.
And in the world of the book, at least as intelligent as humans are themselves.
Yeah.
Taking for granted the implausibility of that...
Mm-hmm.
That these incredibly intelligent creatures would wish to be our servants or even tolerate it.
Doesn't this also break that one rule of sort of animal design that you can only be so big and have a brain that works?
There's a whole bunch of things that are problematic about the scaling factors of the dragons in this book. I mean, just assuming that, you know, they could be that big and still function, which they obviously could. There are massive dinosaurs that used to live and function perfectly well. The biggest problem, I think, is the fact that these dragons are supposed to fly. Well,
they have some sort of gas bag system inside of them.
Yeah, I don't know what gas would be like.
Some lighter than air gas, helium.
Yeah, the dragons are just, they have like a natural source of helium that just spontaneously increases as they grow.
Yeah, that's gotta be it.
Something Why like don't that. The eggs float? Why don't, like, if, because you can't make...
That's a good question.
You can't make matter from nothing.
That's a good question.
So, if they are filled with some lighter than air gas...
It had to come from somewhere.
Where is it coming from? How do they end up with this lighter than air gas?
Yeah.
Birds solve the problem by having hollow bones and by not being bigger than a certain size. Like you get like an albatross or like a California condor or something. And
even bigger, that, they're pushing it.
Yeah, any bigger than that and you get ostriches and emus. And everyone knows how well they fly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's so, you know, setting aside the kind of whiny scientific gripes that we might have with the realism of a book about dragons, I'm sure all of you are just screaming "shut the fuck up" into your car stereos or headphones right now,
as you often do.
Yeah, setting those complaints aside, this book is actually really fun to read.
Yeah.
So it's a story about a British sea captain by the name of William Lawrence, and basically, over the course of a brief adventure at sea, his ship boards a French frigate and ends up capturing a dragon egg. And in this world, when a dragon egg hatches, the dragon immediately imprints on someone in the vicinity. And
although, like, they... did they kind of refute that a little bit? I mean, this is my second time reading it, and then, you know, it's kind of just brought up that maybe they choose, or it's kind of up in the air on that.
Yeah, in the British understanding of dragon husbandry is that when the dragon hatches, it immediately imprints on whoever happens to be holding the harness.
Yeah.
To, you know, say, here, dragon, enslave yourself to me.
This is a very, you know, white man's burden, colonial sort of approach to these massive air beasts that are our best friends.
Yeah.
They will immediately take to the leash.
They wish it, in fact.
Yeah, like...
They long for it.
And this gets subverted somewhat, definitely in the second one, but this one, you kind of get a little hint of that.
Yeah. Novik is definitely conscious of some of the problematic issues that the ideas of dragon husbandry that her characters have.
Yeah.
What those problematic issues might be. But it's still a little bit bizarre. Anyways, the dragon hatches on the ship, and in this world, once you've been bonded to a dragon, you're bonded to that dragon for life, and it basically requires it's a bit of a self-sacrifice, really, because the assumption is that you're not going to be able to function properly in normal, polite Regency society.
And I feel like this is kind of a throwback to the Dragon Riders of Pern series. I read the first one of those a couple months ago by Anne McCaffrey, who on my... a later book says that Tamarere, who's the dragon of the book, is a delightful dragon. So she's kind of like made her name on being books about guys who ride dragons.
Yeah, Anne McCaffrey is the dragon mistress.
Yeah, her stories are kind of far future tales of a distant space colony where this crap falls from the sky called Thread, and it's this sort of like...
It's like a free
radical. It's like a free radical. It's this thing that'll just burn through anything, and dragons, their fire can eliminate this threat. So, the dragons are like the air defense of this planet.
Interesting.
And I feel like the status of the dragon rider in society, in those books, they actually have a telepathic bond with their rider, and this makes for some really weird stuff when the dragons start, you know, banging one another.
There's some pretty weird stuff that happens in this book. There's a little bit of that too,
yeah.
With the, like... actually, I can spoil it, because you guys have all read this. If you haven't... Just FYI, if you haven't read the book yet, seriously, and you're planning to, stop listening now, because I'm about to spoil a weird plot point. But that moment, I'm sure it's in this book, when Lawrence is, like... touching Tamarere's whisker things.
Yeah, his ruff, I think.
Yeah, and Tamarere's like, oh, don't stop.
Yeah.
Oh, that feels good.
After his secondary sexual characteristics have started to develop.
Yeah, yeah.
There is definitely an interesting homosocial undertone between the relationship of these two characters.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the gist is, you know, Lawrence ends up, of course, being the person that this dragon chooses. The dragon turns out to be an exceedingly rare, super powerful kind of dragon.
Yep.
Which, of course, is all kind of par for the course when it comes to pulp science fiction or fantasy novels. Of
You're
course,
always the main gonna be character the best,
has the best of everything, but other people don't quite give him credit for it, and so he's got to be the scrappy underdog who no one quite expects to save the day in the end, and of course he does. But the story is really fascinating perhaps not so much for the plot points, but just for the excitement of reading about the different cultures in the world and how those different cultures have included dragons in them.
Mm-hmm. And the sort of framework for the series going on from this one, because I think there's six of them so far, mm-hmm. it's basically Temeraire and Lawrence end up in some other country, and then
they see this the status of dragons in various different countries across the world. So the second book takes place in China, the third book takes place kind of in the Middle East, and then up into kind of Western Austro-Prussia
mm-hmm.
type area. And fourth book is Africa, I believe. Mm-hmm. Fifth book, I'm speculating it might be North America just based on the title, but I actually don't know because I haven't read it. And the sixth book, I'm told, is Central America.
And there's also Australia in there somewhere. I'm not sure.
Oh, Australia might be the second or the fifth one.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Anyways, they're really, you know, solid books.
Mm-hmm.
If you've sacrificed any number of hours of your life to reading the work of R.A. Salvatore, this is infinitely better written.
I'll take your word for that. I've never had the pleasure.
Well, there's a certain teenage boy that invariably loves reading about the story of Drizzt Do'Urden.
Because he has two swords.
He has two swords and he's black.
Yeah. And he has a panther?
And he has a panther.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Drizzt Do'Urden in a lot of ways is very much like Temeraire, the central dragon character of the books. He's black and he has unbelievable powers,
mm-hmm.
and he's not particularly welcome in regular society, and he's constantly fighting to have his skills and his worth in society to be recognized.
Yeah. I can think of very few books where you're starting off with someone who is a member of the ruling class and then just continues having an awesome
life. Continues being in the ruling class, having an awesome life.
Something like The Great Gatsby. Even,
really, you know, nothing shitty happens to him at all.
Like The Great Gatsby, you know, his lifestyle, you know, there is a sort of tragic backstory and things don't always go well for Gatsby. But there's not too many books where... Maybe P.G. Wodehouse books where, you know, Jeeves and Wooster, he's always pretty rich and he's got his butler and things generally work out okay.
Oh, man. Is that where Wodehouse gets his name from in Archer?
I think so.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I believe so.
I love Adam Reed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, Matt. How did you feel about the book? You have a much more refined literary palette than I do.
Well, I actually read this book back in, looks like 2007 or so. So I read this sort of when they hit big because the sort of...
What Matt's saying is that he was into Temeraire way before it was cool.
Yep. Well, no, I was into Temeraire right as it was announced that it was going to be cool.
Okay. Because so you're a bit of a more pragmatic sort of a literary hipster.
Yeah, I jumped on the bandwagon very, very early.
You're like an insider trader.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was very, very close to the beginning on it. But the sort of larger sphere sort of importance of this book is that it's been optioned by Peter Jackson to be done as a film eventually. This was before The Hobbit was announced to be a 9-hour miniseries of Hobbit walking around.
Yeah. Have you seen The Hobbit? I haven't yet.
I haven't.
I kind of refuse to watch like that many movies about a book that was half as long as any single one of the Lord of the Rings movies, which Peter Jackson somehow managed to fit into a single movie for each.
Yeah, I read The Hobbit when I was in grade 5. Yeah, thought it was a great book. I liked it a lot. I read Lord of the Rings in grade 9, and then just kind of... I watched the movies when they came out, but they haven't really stuck with me. I mean, I don't really have a reason to go see it again.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people just love them, but I feel like the people who love the films are either like your hardcore nerds who just... can't get enough of
yeah
apart
yeah,
from ourselves
we just talked about ourselves as though we're better than hardcore nerds. Well, or even
hear me out here. So, like, yeah, you've got your person who is so into the works of fantasy fiction that they would, you know, just devote their lives to and just enjoying the same thing over and over again. I'm a Star Trek fan, so I understand where this impulse comes from. But I feel like
Star Wars.
Star Wars.
I would consume almost an infinite amount of Star Wars universe related stuff. Yeah. That's true.
And like for some people, but Lord of the Rings is that's the thing they like.
Oh, I honestly, forgive me, all of you, whatever you call yourselves, Lord of the Rings fans,
hobbits.
Yeah, I don't know, but golems probably.
Golems, yeah.
Smeagols.
They like to think they're hobbits. But they're actually Smeagols.
Actually, I feel like they might dress more like Nazgul, so they might call themselves Nazgul.
Maybe.
They might really be in
sounds
like,
tougher
black and like eyeliner and shit.
Yeah.
I just don't get it. I'm sorry. I don't understand your fascination with Tolkien because he is an enjoyable writer. Like he's an enjoyable writer. He wrote
and nothing wrong with the books. They're
four,
fine.
He wrote four great books.
Than most people get.
The Silmarillion is not good.
I never went near that one.
Yeah, it's like trying to read Leviticus.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, good luck to you if you want to read the Silmarillion because it's shit. But I don't know. I just, like, have you heard of George R. R. Martin? Like, have you heard of China Meville? Like, yeah. There are people out there who are writing fantastic fiction. So fantastic, in fact, that you just don't need to continue consuming exclusively Tolkien or, like...
Tolkien derivatives.
Yeah, or placing Tolkien on, like, a crazy pedestal.
Yeah. I think that's probably his greatest strength is that that world-building aspect and the fact that he's a linguist. When you look at the books, it feels like a lot more than it actually is. Like, it is just a book in your hand, but to a certain person, you're going to see that and think, man, this is an entire universe.
It feels like a volume of encyclopedias, almost.
I could spend my whole life here, and a lot of people do, and sure, all power to them.
Well, and for those people who look at, you know, the world-building aspects of Tolkien from the Lord of the Rings and Hobbit books, one attractive feature, I think, of the Temeraire novels is the fact that they all have a glossary at the back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a great number of invented words that you will...
There's a glossary in yours?
I think so.
I don't have one.
Maybe it's not that there's a...
Maybe there's one later. Like, there is a... There's observations on the Order Draconia in Europe with notes on the Oriental breeds. So you do get sort of a supplement from a study of dragon sort of physiology.
Not a glossary in the back. I'm confusing myself with something else.
That might be a later one.
But there, no, it isn't a later one. Huh. I'm totally just confusing it with Anathem, which is totally a way better book.
That Anathem is a fantastic book.
but
I don't know. It does different things.
Still, from the aspect of a person who's really into world building, there is a lot to be had from these books. That's one of the things that I think are most attractive about them. At the end of every book, there is a brief section, you know, from the sketchbook of Sir Edward Howe. You have some pictures of the different dragons in harness, or you have an extract from some kind of scientific paper.
Yeah, a treatise.
On the various breeds of dragons and their type of their weights and so forth. So there's some really interesting stuff to read, but it's not particularly extensive.
I'm a fan of alternate history, so that aspect of it really works for me because, like some people with the Tolkien or yourself with Star Wars, you can kind of extrapolate, whereas like I studied history in school, so I know a fair bit about the Napoleonic period, and it's interesting to see like what would have been it like if there'd been an air battle going on at the same time, or if you could have had reconnaissance flights, or like it changes the way the entire war was fought. And you know, the ending of this book has a kind of amazingly preposterous scenario that had that happened, we would have been living in an entirely different world today. Like,
truly. The final climactic battle.
Yeah.
This is the spoiler show. So,
yeah.
The final climactic battle where Napoleon has basically created a bunch of aerial troop carriers that are carried by like five or six dragons apiece and just flown across the channel
above the blockade.
Above the blockade. It's an incredible idea. And I think Naomi Novik has a kind of profound respect and appreciation for, or perhaps not a respect or an appreciation, but a profound impression of Napoleon's tactical skills.
Yeah.
To see him as the sort of person who could kind of think outside the box and come up with a cool solution.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I'm going to say a name here that might piss a lot of people off, but it actually reminded me a lot of...
Adolf Hitler.
No.
Because that's a name that would piss people off.
No, actually, Orson Scott Card's book.
Oh.
I think they're the Alvin Maker Chronicles.
Yes, of course. Raging homophobe, yes. Orson Scott Card.
Yeah, I read these back when I was in junior high. And well before I really
Orson,
liked them.
Orson Scott Card was a well-known...
Well, he was well-known, but...
Super PAC donating.
I believe he... Well, it was before Super PACs were a thing, but it was... I don't think it was as well-known to, you know, junior high students in Canada that... Like, I read Ender's Game, and then I read all of those, and then...
Well, and nor would it have been a big deal.
Yeah, it wasn't as big a deal as opposed to now.
Yeah.
Orson Scott Card has just been contracted to write some Superman stories, and DC Comics is getting a lot of flack because he's virulently homophobic.
He's writing the new Man of Steel, right?
Yeah, I think it's starting as a digital first, and then it's going to printed comic. Anyway, he has written an alternate history series, which if you're into this book, you might enjoy as well. It's called The Alvin Maker Chronicles, and it's another alternate history of the 19th century, where everyone on Earth, apart from a few people, when you're born, you have a knack for something, which is sort of a miniature little superpower that everyone has.
Mm-hmm.
So you might be able to make a barrel that's really, really strong, or you might be able to run... you know, super-duper fast for 10 seconds or something like that. Mm-hmm. Everyone's got one of those. And Napoleon's power is that, if I remember right, he can make you do whatever he says. He's super charismatic, which kind of follows with Napoleon, right?
Sure.
And the main character is someone who can make...
incredibly smelly farts.
Well, he can make anything.
That was some low-hanging fruit, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. He's what is called a maker who can... make something out of nothing.
Cool.
The last one of these was Benjamin Franklin, who basically used it to, you know, help kickstart the American country. So this kid who learns his power...
He made America.
Yeah, he built America from literally nothing. And then this kid, you know, he goes on to influence geopolitics because, you know, if you have the ability to make cannons out of, you know, just... meld something into something else. It's great.
Yeah.
And this is, you know,
it makes for an amazing deus ex machina.
Oh, yeah.
Just like Temeraire's convenient development of a superpower at the very end of the book as it's climaxing while Napoleon is carrying his troops over in little relatively flimsy wooden rafts. Temeraire develops the amazing ability to basically sonic boom his voice and blow up all of the ships, or at least enough of the ships that they get scared and turn around and
he takes out a couple. Well,
yeah.
A little bit of harm.
I mean, no harm is done to England.
Yeah. It's interesting to also read these books from the perspective of someone who enjoys fiction from the Regency period, such as Jane Austen novels, because Lawrence isn't too far off from a Jane Austen character himself. In fact, he goes to his family's estate and is immediately ostracized because he's joined the Air Corps. And it's difficult for someone who's read stuff from that period to think about, like, because soldiers were such an attractive marriage prospect because they did pretty well for themselves. And mm-hmm. when they weren't fighting Napoleon, I mean, you could work in the militia or something, but mm-hmm. you did all right. But to have a class of people who gasp include women amongst their ranks.
Though that's a secret, I think.
Yeah, it is a secret to the general public, but there is just sort of a general rapscallionness to their nature.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to think of, you know, because these are modern sort of heroes that would not exist at this time at all.
Yeah, and I think part of the weirdness of the book is the idea that the dragons seem to bring out this side of people. The dragons are these incredibly free-thinking... They're like incredibly free-thinking, modern-thinking, sentient beings.
Temeraire gets called a Jacobin at some point, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're these incredibly free-thinking beings who are somehow not bothered by the idea of being enslaved.
Yeah.
And treated like garbage, as they are by the British.
And then later on you find out that certain other cultures have basically deified these creatures, and the entire social strata of China, completely different.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating how she is able to sort of take the idea of, you know, the different dynasties in China and then say, well, you know, dragons would be running that place.
Yeah.
And yeah, that is another really good part of the book, is that, yeah, she's done her homework. She's quite good at, you know, thinking of backstory.
She's certainly done her homework as far as the backstory is concerned. Mm-hmm. The one disappointing thing about this book is I think I rather experienced it like you must have experienced Prometheus.
Mm.
Where...
Overthink it?
Yeah. As soon as you... it's one of those things that's really tantalizing. It's really delectable when you first experience it. But as you start to try and pick it away, to go deeper, as you would if you were reading like a Neal Stephenson book.
Sure.
You could try and go deeper and go deeper in a Neal Stephenson novel, and it responds well to that.
Yeah.
There's depth enough there that you can probe, and the story holds up.
Yeah.
Things still make sense.
That kind of comes from Stephenson. I would say Stephenson is probably working with the real world as a basis, especially with regards to science and math. Like, he has those to fall back on, whereas starting a whole alternate history from whole cloth where dragons exist, here's the social, you know, strata, the entire world is completely different.
Yeah.
Oh, some things don't hold up to scrutiny. Yeah, that's going to happen.
Sorry, what word was that?
Scrutiny.
Oh, okay, because I heard scrutiny.
Yeah.
And so did our listeners.
Well, they definitely heard it when you said it. That's true. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There are definitely some things about the book that don't hold up to scrutiny. The realism of the dragons, for one. The idea of, the dragons' personalities being so very open-minded and free-thinking, mm-hmm. and yet still completely compatible with becoming happy slaves, like happy-go-lucky, beaten-on slaves.
It is interesting, though, because, like, is that too far off from the people of this period, too? Everyone was told to do their duty. Like, Temeraire is essentially a British citizen when it comes down to it,
mm-hmm.
and he's, you know, he's happy in his duty, and that's something we don't really have as an idea anymore, that one would be happy doing one's duty. And
but he's not really happy doing his duty. Like, the reason that, you know, they're calling him a Jacobin is because he's not really so much happy doing his duty as he is just really closely bonded with Lawrence.
Yeah, and that's, and so, well, think about it. Like, that goes back all the way to Corinth. You're not fighting for your country, you're fighting for the guy next to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your duty is to protect your friends, and by virtue of that, protect the nation. And it's essentially a love story between these two ostensibly male characters. Like, Temeraire is a dragon, so
yeah,
his sexuality is a little in check. But it's basically, you know, it's a romantic friendship, not unlike Sam and Frodo.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much Sam. There's some seriously
Homosocial.
Homosocial interactions between the two of them.
Yeah.
They're very lovingly gay for each other. Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of sweet.
I'm sure that probably this is a whole section of the fan base. The sort of, you know, the Slash section.
Oh, yeah.
That's got to be a huge draw.
Yeah, there must be some Lawrence Temeraire interspecies sex.
I'm sure if we went on Live Journal.
Or unfulfilled romance or erotic passion.
It even comes up at some point when Temeraire is kind of thinking of the idea of, like, why am I this way? Why can't I be a person like you? Why can't you be a dragon like me?
Yeah.
It would be so great if we could fly around together, wouldn't it? Yeah. And then there's kind of a wistful sort of moment like, yeah, that would be pretty great. And then, oh, wait. We have to go fight Napoleon now.
Yeah.
It's time to be masculine. We can't think about our feelings too much.
For me, I think my favorite character in the book has to be Captain Lawrence.
Yeah.
Because he's really the character, like, he's the straight man that mm-hmm. sells the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that he is the character that he is, this very, Wuthering Heights-y sort of...
Wuthering Heights, I don't know, man.
Well, whatever.
Is kind of a douchebag.
Okay, that's true. He's not... He's
more of a Mr. Darcy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Mr. Darcy or a...
If you've seen Downton Abbey, have you?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a season one Mr. Bates.
Yeah.
Like, just an awesome dude.
Yeah, he's... no, I feel like he's more straight-laced than Mr. Bates. He reminds me of, what is it? Jane Eyre. Who's the dude in Jane Eyre?
Rochester. Yeah.
He reminds me somewhat of Rochester.
Yeah. Just a guy.
Like,
who's...
he's an inherently nice guy, but he's, like, also very stern.
Yeah. And he's been dealt kind of a difficult hand for his time in life.
Like, yeah, and he has this sort of noble carriage of himself that he's going to, you know, he's going to tough it out and just do what needs to be done.
Yeah.
I think his credulity in believing the world around him and, mm-hmm. and interacting with it the way that he does, his credulity is what sells mm-hmm. the book to me.
It's true.
Like, if he was, like, diving in wholeheartedly and, like, being like, yeah, you're right, Temeraire. We should make everyone, you know, totally accept dragons.
Yeah.
And, like, we should, make all these sweeping social changes that are totally anachronistic.
Yeah.
And, correspond very closely to what is coincidentally the morals and ethics of the 21st century.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should totally do that.
Yeah.
If he was like that, I'd be like, yeah, okay, this is silly.
He is actually, he is definitely the straight man. He is kind of appalled by some of the working conditions of the Air Corps, and especially the idea of women in combat. But he does sort of, you know, stiff upper lip his way through and eventually start to recognize, like, yeah, this, it's got to work, because mm-hmm. some of the dragons only accept women.
In fact, I would say the thing that makes me slightly less inclined to continue reading the series. I've read the first three books. The thing that makes me slightly less inclined to continue reading the series, aside from the fact that they're eventually going to run out of continents, and I don't know how I'm going to feel about,
Antarctic dragons?
Yeah,
that would be cool, kind
of. It would be cool, but...
Could work a little Lovecraft in there, too.
Oh, that would actually be really cool.
Yeah.
Cthulhu dragons or...
Yeah. Well, the... At the Mountains of Madness, I think they went to Antarctica? Yeah.
Yeah, and there they found those leathery winged sponge...
The elder things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe that could happen.
Dragons. Yeah. They could be the dragons of Antarctica.
That would be neat. And everyone would have to team up and fight those guys.
All the dragons go insane when they start to try and talk to the elder things.
That's really cool. That should happen.
The dragons realize that they are elder things.
Yeah, they're just descended from the elder things. did we figure out the ending of the whole cycle? I'm not sure. That would be really cool.
We might just have figured it out. Aside from the fact that I think that the shtick of going from continent to continent and just checking out, like, you know, artificially creating a reason for Tamarere and Lawrence to go to some other continent just to see how things go in that on that continent. I feel like that's a bit of artifice that I'm not particularly fond of. Like, I would rather it be a more, like...
organic?
I would just rather it... I would rather the story more closely follow, like, the fight with Napoleon.
Mm-hmm.
For most of the second book, for all of the second book, they're completely out of touch with the war that's going on.
Yeah.
Because they're in China. For about half of the third book, they're completely divorced from it as well. And it's only in the second half of the book that there's any contact whatsoever with the West, and therefore the battle with Napoleon. But even then, it's from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there, it's still kind of a cross-cultural thing.
Yeah.
I want Tamarere to just kind of... like, I want them to be more doing their duty and having, you know, just seeing how the world changes as a result of having dragons in it.
Yeah.
As much as I like hearing about what the different cultures of dragons are like in the world, it takes away somewhat from the stuff that I think makes the book truly good.
Yeah, and yeah, definitely the first one. It feels almost like the first Star Wars, where you can kind of appreciate it on its own.
Yeah.
And afterwards, you kind of have to expand the universe a little bit. And yeah, the war against Napoleon is only going to go so long. I would be interested in seeing what happens 100 years later. I'd be interested in seeing how long the Paris Commune holds out against dragons attacking from all the countries in addition to the armies.
Yeah.
I would be interested in seeing what the socialist uprising with the dragon slave race would look like.
That would be pretty
fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Like, those are the plot points that I think would be really interesting. The mm-hmm. historical plot points, as opposed to the cultural plot points of, okay, this is what dragons are like in this culture.
Yeah, you can only be a fish out of water so many times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that aspect of it, I'm not crazy about. And the other aspect about it that makes me a little bit less inclined to continue reading them after this third book is the fact that Lawrence is gradually becoming more and more of an anachronistic man. Like, the character is becoming less and less believable as a straight-laced nobleman who has been thrust into this awkward position, and he's more and more just kind of embracing the free spirit of his dragon companion and being like, I agree with you, Tamarere. Like, I would run away with you if we had to. Like,
yeah.
I would leave my post and we could go to America.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. And I guess we would get into, I don't know, you'd get into Confederation of Canada. Like, there is some pretty interesting history that happens afterwards. It feels almost like 1810, 1812, around then. It's maybe a little bit early for these sort of things to be happening without greater social change behind them.
Yeah. Like, I would be more interested, I think, I'm not so attached to the idea of Tamarere and Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
What I would have liked, perhaps, and of course this is a silly thing to be saying since the books have already been written, but what I would like to have seen was maybe a book about Will Lawrence and Tamarere, and then a book taking place in a completely different time period about a different person. And,
well, again, their the prequel dragon. Idea of who was the first asshole smart, like, dumb enough to jump on top of a dragon.
Yeah, exactly. Or how do dragons and cell phone? Like, are you supposed to not ride your dragon and have a cell phone at the same time? Like, does everyone...
good question.
Is, you know, it starts off as this niche thing. By the 21st century, does everyone have a dragon?
Yeah.
You know, like our...
or is it like commercial air travel nowadays?
Yeah.
What does that do for technology when, you know, the driving factor of airplanes don't need those? We're never going to try to invent propeller planes. We're never going to invent jets.
Or maybe they do, and that's kind of
the
the proletariat sky chariot is an airplane.
See, this is getting into China Miéville territory, where you would have the conflict between mechanization and then biotechnology, which is essentially what dragon breeding is.
Yeah.
This is, yeah, it's kind of going towards that angle. And who knows, maybe that is her end game. I'm sure it's probably going to end in a pretty big battle against Napoleon.
Yeah.
If you guys remember the episode I did with Devin Bruce a couple weeks ago, we were talking about Star Trek and how the sort of adventure fiction format of just rolling around, running into things, see what happens. I mean, that's all well and good, but I would enjoy a TV show about the Federation. I would like a West Wing about the Federation. What would that be like? What's it like running that?
Yeah, to go slightly larger scale than just the continued drama that you got from Deep Space Nine,
mm-hmm.
and
Deep Space Nine was the best of all those too, because it had an ongoing storyline, whereas the other ones they could maybe do one or two arcs. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean Voyager had a bit of an ongoing, like Voyager tried to kind of toe the line between. Yeah. Deep Space Nine and Next Generation.
Yeah.
And it did a reasonably good job. I mean, I know some people consider it their favorite.
But yeah, these aren't, like, this idea that both Marcus and I are going for, it's not exactly conducive to long-running series without a ton of work in doing it, because you'd have to think out basically every sort of just thing spiraling out of a decision like, we killed Napoleon, what do we do next?
Yeah.
Like it is so far divorced from reality at that point that everything is different, and it has moved beyond, you know, historical fantasy into outright just complete speculation.
Yeah.
So apart from that, like they're fun books.
Fun books, and I totally would recommend anyone who wants like a nice piece of enjoyable rompy summer fiction.
What would you compare it to if someone else was a fan of something?
That's a good question.
Well, I would compare it to the Horatio Hornblower novels, Flashman, which is something I've read very little of, but I feel like I'd really get into. It's novels about similar era, but he's a or Sharps, those Sharps rifles. Those sort of books about, you know, adventuring in the early 19th century, easily understandable opponent Napoleon. It's definitely, you know, far away from real politic. It's just fun, like swashbuckling, shooting off blunderbusses and rifles and stuff. It's just, you know, it's a good time all around. So I recommend it towards that crowd.
I would say in terms of readability, and kind of the pulpiness of it, it reminds me a lot of those, like, old Forgotten Realms, or I guess not even really old, R.A. Salvatore just keeps cranking them out, but, like, all of those Dritz Doerden novels from Forgotten Realms. I think they'll appeal to that set of people who aren't necessarily looking for,
sociological implications.
Quote-unquote quality of literature so much as just a really exciting romp. And, of course, the advantage of these is that, you know, coincidentally, in addition to the exciting romp that you'll get, you're actually going to read a very well-written book.
And you're
going
to learn a little bit about history, too.
Yeah.
And some of this stuff actually happened.
Yeah, which is a cool element as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd also recommend it to people who have perhaps more of a historical background and aren't necessarily really into science fiction or fantasy, because this is a really interesting combination of fantasy and historical elements. And I think that people who are into historical fiction or historical fact, I think they could probably very easily sink their teeth into this book. And you know, like I said earlier, it's a 300-page book, but I read it in 12 hours. So it's not a complicated read. It's very enjoyable, and it's not a huge time commitment. So, you know, if you're worried about, sinking hours and hours of your life into a particular book, you're not going to have to worry about losing too much time to this. And I think it's a worthy investment.
Yeah, I'd also just thought of it now, thinking of that alternate history angle, Harry Turtledove. Mm-hmm. His you know, his books about what would happen if the South won the Civil War, or what would happen if aliens invaded during World War II. Just sort of that, you know, speculation on what if a little thing was different. Yeah. Well, here's one big thing is different, but it's still pretty well researched and just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Should we sell me on us?
I think this whole episode's been basically a sell me on it. So let's just point the listeners towards next week's, next month's reading selection.
That's a good point. We're very pleased to recommend that all of us read the Foundation trilogy. Are we going to read all three of them, or just
the first one?
Okay, so we're going to read Foundation by Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, this is one I've never read, but I know it's like a cultural touchstone, like a canonical work of science fiction. I feel I probably should read it. Like, I've read things influenced by it, and I feel like this is one that I should have read by now, and I'm excited to read it.
Yeah, I just recently purchased it. It was on, for those of you who are down with science fiction and fantasy, and you spend a lot of time on the internet, if you haven't already heard of io9.com, mm-hmm. I don't know what you've been doing on the internet.
They're pretty great.
It's pretty sweet. Every once in a while, they'll put up lists of like the 50 best science fiction fantasy novels, or the 50... or like the 25 science fiction fantasy novels that you must read, and Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy is consistently among those. So
it's almost like he named it that way. This is going to be the foundation of our entire literature from now on.
Yeah. So I'm really excited. I've never read anything by Asimov.
I think I've read short stories. Yeah, I haven't read much Asimov either. I think I read more Asimov in comparative literature class than I actually did, you know, just like for fun.
As pleasure reading.
Yeah. Yeah. So this will be really interesting.
Because, yeah, I'm really excited about it, and hopefully because it's a little bit more of a serious reader's novel, perhaps we can find a guest who will be willing to come on and read with us, and
we'll be able to speak with us.
Speak with us at the end of March.
And the basic gist of the book, as far as I'm aware, is that human scientists have figured out that there's going to be a great calamity ahead of us. So they develop a new branch of science which aims to steer humanity away from the worst of the calamity that's going to happen.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's social engineering on the grandest scale imaginable.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I'm definitely seeing the influence of this book. If the plot is actually that, I'm definitely seeing the influence on a whole bunch of other works of fiction that have come out since then. So that's a really cool idea.
I think it's psychohistory.
Yeah.
Is the name of the discipline they develop.
Sweet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, kids. Yeah. We hope that you enjoyed His Majesty's Dragon, or if you cheated and you didn't read it, but you listened to this entire episode anyways, I hope that somehow, in spite of the spoilers, you're willing to check it out, because it is a worthwhile read.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, recommend it to someone who you think would like it and hasn't read it. Cause
might not be your bag, but you'll know someone who might like it.
Yeah, it is a worthwhile read, and it's cool to support people who have Edmonton connections.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah. All my love to your mothers.